when they hold your hands, when they give you a hug, when they say, thank you for caring about me, thank you for helping me, thank you. You know, if you connect somebody to the right resource and all of a sudden have access to some kind of research or health insurance or something, you kind of really change their lives.
Hi, and welcome to Keeping Up with Public Health from the Western Region Public Health Training Center. I'm your host, Sana Khan. Each week, I'm going to chat with the most active public health researchers about the latest developments in public health. Learn about practical applications of the latest research underway at the University of Arizona's Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health.
I'm sitting here with Dr. David Garcia, who is a member of the University of Arizona Cancer Center, as well as Rosie Vogel, who is the Nosotros Senior Program Coordinator. So if you just want to take a minute and introduce yourself.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm Rosie Vogel, and actually was born in Mexico City many years ago. And I went to college there, and I actually went to college for business and economics, and then I moved to Tucson. And I was in the business field for many years, and I own a business. But life is the best teacher we have, and life dealt me some interesting cards, and I was kind of faced to deal with health issues within my own family. So it changed my perspective completely, and I became kind of like an advocate, and then I started volunteering and serving in different boards around my community, mostly social justice. And working with social justice and seeing really the injustice that is in our community, because I grew up kind of like in a bubble, and then I was discovering all these people in the community that don't have access to information, to health, to education. So it became kind of like a passion to me. So most of my life, what has really mattered to me has been my volunteer work. And my volunteer work landed me a job at Banner doing diabetes education. And that gave me the opportunity to meet Dr. Garcia and his team. And I just thought it was fascinating, all the things that they were doing, and that's how I discovered really the field of public health. And then somebody told me, well, you've been doing this all your life since you came to Tucson, yeah. Just didn't know it. So it was great to actually find a place where I can apply my passion, but also I can learn and bring my business, education, and experience, yeah. Because I do kind of manage the team as a business, which has been really, really good. Mm-hmm. But also the opportunity to now have the research and the knowledge to really help people in a more scientific but humanely and way. So that's how I ended up here. It was kind of, I think life just brought me here.
Yeah, what a journey. I think, well, I want to say first of all, thank you, because I think advocacy work and social justice work is so important in healthcare and in public health. And you mentioned access issues, border issues, just trying to be an advocate for maybe those who aren't in the best position to seek healthcare. I think that's so important. So
yeah,
thank you for your volunteer work at Banner and everything. You led me to believe that you weren't going to be like the best natural speaker, and you're doing great.
Well, and you said when you speak from the heart, right?
Yeah.
So. I just remember once I had to fight for the rights of my kids, and I'm here, and mm-hmm. It took me like 13 months, and I did it, and success, and I felt so good, and I learned, like, you know what? I have a voice,
yeah. And
I just need to speak up, you know? But then I realized so many people don't know how to, or they're afraid, so then I became mm-hmm. that voice to those people.
Yeah. And what about you, Dr. Garcia? What about your journey
here? Yeah, so I was born in Sierra Vista. Arizona, which is about 15 miles, I guess, north of the border. But I moved to like South Tucson area when I was like a year old. So basically was raised in Tucson, went back to Sierra Vista, went to high school in Tombstone High School, which is pretty unique. Had a bus in 20 miles every day, kind of, again, access and issues, right? Rural area.
Oh, yeah.
So that was an interesting experience, but then had the opportunity to go back east for my training. So I got a bachelor's in exercise science, my master's and PhD in exercise physiology, but ultimately had the opportunity to come back home, as I call it, for my postdoc, and now as an assistant professor. So I've been back for 6 years now, and throughout this process, in reality, kind of like what I said, like life kind of just takes you places, is that... You know, I wanted to come back for, like, my and our community, right?
Yeah.
because of those, what you were talking about really, right, was like the health disparities aspect. There's obviously significant health disparities that exist, whether that's the context of, you know, so I do a lot of obesity prevention and treatment work right there, specifically in Hispanic men. But in addition to that, just being a voice, right, just giving people the autonomy to get that care and just having the opportunity. So that's kind of like the underpinning of what we do. Yeah. We try to be a voice for the community. Yeah. So that's kind of what led me here, and I love it.
So I think we kind of glossed over exactly what the Nosotros program is, and I know you are the director for the program, so you can talk
about
that. Thank you.
I am the coordinator, but
director.
She can take director.
But I'll change it now to director.
Yeah, I deemed it, so
no,
it's
perfect.
It's happening
so it's
now.
Done.
Yes,
there you go.
It's official.
So Nosotros is a program that was developed to foster community-engaged research collaborations, service and education to advance health equity. And our mission is to reduce health disparities faced by the Hispanic community in Southern Arizona. So that's what guides us to do all the research that we're doing. So last summer, our research project then was the Nosotros Network, and we still have it, you know, going on. And then Nosotros Network, we were interested in learning from the community, not only what are the health issues that they experience, but what are the health interests that they have. And everybody assumes type 2 diabetes or obesity, but we were kind of surprised that for a lot of them it was vision care.
Oh.
And so that's why it is important to take the time to go to a community-based setting and ask them. And you'll be surprised the first time, it's like, well, this questionnaire is kind of lengthy, they're going to be busy. You'll be surprised how many people are like, okay, you want to really listen to me? Let me tell you what matters to me.
Yeah.
And so that was really, so that's really great about the network, that we're really collecting knowledge from the community. What matters to you? So we can see what afflicts them health-wise, but also what they care for themselves and for their kids. Another thing that we were asking them is like, will you be interested in participating in research? And wow, yes, they are interested in participating. And that was really amazing, because some people feel like, no, they're not interested. And I may say this many times, you know, during our podcast today, but one of the reasons is, and to be quite honest, I was also surprised to learn this, it was the altruistic nature. A lot of them are like, well, I want you to you know, I want to share this information for future generations.
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of people view the Hispanic community as altruistic. They probably see them more like, we need resources, we need help, and actually they're giving us something in return, you know, that knowledge that they're sharing with us, so we can use it for future research, for future generations. So that was really cool for me to learn from those people, that they want to do it for the sake of the society.
Yeah.
If it's not us, who will be? It's not now, when, right? They're telling us it's our obligation now to listen and to act on that. And another good thing about the network is, like, I say, well, sometimes you don't know what you don't know. So sometimes I don't even know what to ask, what kind of resources. So that can sometimes motivate them to think outside the box and like, oh, yes, mental illness. I was very surprised how open they were. And, you know, this is research, and, you know, you have to go through IRB and all that. So we really protect the people's privacy. So we're very respectful of that. But so try to connect them. They don't know what resources are out there.
Oh, yeah.
So that's one of the main goals of the Nosotros Network, to connect them to other resources and health initiatives in the community. And so I'm also in charge of retention. So every time I know there's like a health fair event, or back to school giving backpacks, or you know, dental work for kids, I share that with the members of the network. And, you know, not everybody, but some reply, thank you very much for saying that. So it's just really nice to, like you said, the long term, you know, the continuity of this, like keep them informed with resources that can be helpful to them. So that's something really special about the network.
Yeah, and very rewarding. What would you say is your favorite part of being a part of this program, or what the most fulfilling aspect of it is?
It's easy. You know, I love the personal interaction with people. I love the research because I love to learn, and I learn a lot from Dr. Garcia. I'm like, oh yeah, I did my first IRB.
that was not really fun. Why are you so excited?
I was really scared the first time he said, just do it. And I came to him, I said, okay. I didn't want to admit, like, had no clue. And then I came back and I said, I'm sorry, but I have to be honest with you. I don't know. And he said, I know. You're going to learn, and you're going to do it. And I did it, right?
I think you're the only person I've ever seen to be excited about an IRB.
And I read the whole thing, and yeah. I think I brought some knowledge. Like, you did know that they made these changes?
I think we laugh about that still. I was like, Rosie, you'll do it. And she's like, okay. Then a week later, like, hey, I still need help.
I think, yeah, and I was like, you're like pulling a prank on
her. I
was like,
I didn't expect you to do it. And I was like,
but that's a good way.
But you seem very determined. Yeah. I wouldn't put it past you to, like,
well, I didn't want to let him down.
She ran with it. She ran with it.
But I think that's something that Dr. Garcia has in with our team, you know? He pushes you to at least try it. Otherwise, oh, don't worry, Rosie, don't dwell. They're like, okay. But when he said, like, so I was forced to go to the website and learn. I tell you, I'm such a geek. I learned I read every link.
Let me actually recap some of this, because Nosotros, and we went into networking, that was good, because that's one of the, so Nosotros, the program, was really developed, like, I guess, like five years ago, actually. Okay. So it was myself and Luis Valdez, who's a former doctoral student in the College of Public Health. He's now an assistant professor at UMass Amherst.
Oh.
And so Luis and I developed Nosotros really when we recognized that we had established that, like, that trust in the community. It's not just like the U of A, it's that branding, right? Because in reality, I always tell our group that we're salespeople. We sell health. And to do that, you know, you have to establish trust and have the rapport. So it's been over 6 years. So Rosie was describing the network, which is one project that we developed last year to really close that gap, like help link the community to research and other health initiatives. But in addition to that, you know, we've done beverage interventions for Hispanic adults, which that's how I met Rosie,
and that
actually.
That was before my time.
Yeah,
so
before
sorry,
time.
Sorry, kind of like.
No, it's okay. No, it's okay. You know, Animo is the first gender and culturally sensitive weight loss intervention ever developed for Hispanic men. So that was actually published yesterday. So that's officially in the literature. In addition to that, like Luis actually hit his work. Was alcohol use, substance abuse amongst Latino men, which is a really taboo topic, and he did that very well. His other and better half, and I know they're going to listen to this, so that's why I said that, Elizabeth Valdez, recently received her PhD as well, and her focus was alcohol use, substance abuse, and border adolescents in Douglas. So Nosotros in general always also dark tobacco sensation. So our group has effectively done like community outreach and engagement within the context of recruitment and just being in the community for multiple behaviors. And I think what, like, again, in the network, and then we'll talk about the new project. The things that I think drive this, well, is one, Rosie, thank you. Really couldn't do it without her. So she doesn't do all the IRBs and everything, but she runs the team. Because that's the beauty about Nosotros is, you kind of mentioned this, it's the group. So we have trained over 5-6 years, you know, Luis being assistant professor now, the students that have come through, we've trained over 60-some students, whether it's internships or being part of clinical trials or whatever else, because that's kind of how I got my start as well. So we're heavily invested in training and really bringing up the next wave, like you said, like making sure that we bring people up. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the key to like Nosotros, is that any given time, that students are being trained within the context of like health disparities or outreach or whatever. So that's really the strength, because it's not just, again, we learn a lot from the students. The students are from Yuma, Douglas, in some cases Mexico, and they know, they have their finger on the pulse as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of what's unique, is that, and again, anybody who does public health research knows that it's, seeing people that are similar or have similar backgrounds or can at least understand makes a difference. And even if you're out in the community, you know, even like having me out, you know, so we do a lot at swap meets, even having me out there and just being able to point to me, like, that's Dr. Garcia over there. Like, I'm out there with like the kids and so forth. And just having that context context mm-hmm. matters, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so Nosotros in general, I think, again, just cause mm-hmm. obviously you're here, it's largely because of Rosie, but that's some of the history, you know, is that's this team really couldn't do without them, without Rosie.
You mentioned your work with Hispanic men in health disparities. I was reading one of the papers that you put out with Dr. Bell. A lot of it was over my head, the statistic part anyway, but I think the line that jumped out to me from that paper was they are the most uninsured population. Is that what was the statistic?
There's a lot of things going on with Hispanic men. I came here 6 years ago. You know, at the time, I got extensive training in like lifestyle treatment for obesity. NIH, a lot of people have invested significant money in weight loss research. However, at that time, no one had developed a weight loss intervention specifically for Hispanic men, although we have the highest prevalence of overweight and obesity amongst men in the U.S. So about 8 out of 10 of us are overweight or obese. So that was kind of alarming, is that, you know, again, we have the largest rates, right? However, at the time, no one had even developed a gender and culturally sensitive weight loss intervention for Hispanic men. So that kind of set the trajectory of where do we fill the gap. So that was kind of like the impetus for like my work of trying to fill that gap, but also acknowledging the disparities that exist. So like what's really going on? Well, it may be an access issues to healthy foods. We do consume lower fruits and vegetables overall. There's higher consumption of sugar sweetened beverages in general. You know, and again, it goes to the term, like, this is one of the debates, I think, even in public health, whether it's access or knowledge. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, it's not just having access to said foods or even, you know, that it's providing the education piece or helping people understand that they
being
have
an advocate, like you mentioned.
Yeah, being an advocate and that they have a choice.
Yeah, and having that knowledge and being able to study, that's definitely a privilege, both from the mm-hmm. access and knowledge Absolutely. Point. Being able to have the access in itself is a privilege, and then the knowledge piece to it. So I think if you do know, it is really important to be an advocate, especially in your own communities.
And, Absolutely.
Yeah, going back, I definitely relate to that. You mentioned gender and culturally sensitive weight loss interventions. So in the past, historically, why are the weight loss interventions that are maybe at the top or what get cited a lot, why are those not gender and culturally sensitive?
So I think there's multiple layers.
Okay.
So in general, there's underpinnings to weight loss interventions. So, you know, at a very basic level, I'm going to change your diet by giving you a very prescriptive caloric goal based off your body weight. I'm going to give you a physical activity recommendation that's going to increase over time, you know, within like a 6 month period. And then I'm going to give you very specific lessons or focus to like try to change your behaviors over like 16 different lessons. I think that's fine, again, right? So I think at a very basic level, if you apply that to a general population, largely non-Hispanic white populations, mm-hmm. that may like be applicable. Okay. So those who enroll in this is a generalization, but the foundation of those interventions have come from the East Coast, right? That's where I was trained.
Yes.
That's where most of us kind of filter down who do this work. So it's taken time to really take a step back and acknowledge that it's not a one-size-fits-all.
Yes.
That there are just inherent differences. So for instance, from a perspective of, you know, gender or sex, So traditional settings are group settings for weight loss interventions. So majority, about 65-70% of these study populations are women. So even if you have men interspersed into those group settings, generally they're very quiet, right? Just based off my experience at the University of Pittsburgh. So it is not appropriate to develop a weight loss intervention for men, potentially, that is in a group-based setting that is more centered around, you know, a very didactic approach.
Definitely.
Like, I'm gonna talk to you about something, versus having potentially a one-on-one discussion, or perhaps tailoring the program to, again, like maybe a sport or whatever.
Yeah.
So I guess that's kind of the context, is that the frameworks are good. We know that we have to change diet. We know we have to change activity. We know we have to focus on like stimulus control or how to overcome barriers to anything. However, we fail to acknowledge that there are just inherent differences.
Yes.
Not only within the context of gender, but even culture, right?
Oh, yeah.
and really kind of leveraging that. And also not even just from a surface adaptation. So a surface adaptation is really, we match for language preference or, like male-to-male interaction, let's just say. However, there's like the deep structure. So really acknowledging like the role of, let's say, gender role strain. So when we would talk with our men, for instance, the role as the provider, the role within like the family and how that kind of plays into this context. So really kind of getting a deep down, a deep structure approach.
Like you said, it's not one size fits all. You definitely have to figure out how culture comes into play when you're talking about that.
It's important to recognize that, but also let the community tell you what they want.
Yeah.
So, for instance, just to take a little step back, before we even developed the ANIMO study, which is the gender and culturally sensitive weight loss intervention that you're talking about, we, again, within the context of public health, did qualitative interviews.
Yeah.
We went out and recruited and also let the community tell us how we should approach them.
Yeah.
In addition to that, like, I care about weight loss. I care about physical activity, et cetera. The community needed to tell me. So we did qualitative work. We did survey-based work to actually just ask the guys, do you care about this? And if you do, then we will help develop that and then engage them in the process of developing that.
Yeah, and this podcast is definitely the audience, is the public health workforce, and
yes.
I think one of the biggest problems we have in public health that we've all recognized at this point is it's not a great look when you come into a community, especially one that you're not a part of or identify with, and then you come in and you just tell people what to do because, or because you have the doctorate or because that's what you want to do, but actually going into a community, getting that information using surveys or just honestly those one-on-one conversations, I think that is really what makes a study successful versus not successful.
Well, I think we could talk about some of the thing, but I think some aspect is, we were talking earlier about altruism, but in addition to that is that people don't see degrees. People don't see anything. They see that you care. So I always say that the key to a successful research study or anything for that matter with public health is to have the community or anybody else that you talk to understand that you're not looking at them as data, that they are people with real issues, with real problems that are not going to be solved within the context of your research study.
Yeah.
If you have that heart, if you lead with your heart, right, then everything else will follow. That's just kind of how I've always lived my life. But I think Rosie may have something to talk
about. Yeah, please,
what are
some of the, community stories that you've...
Yeah, so I was going to say it has to be relatable to them. And I really believe a big part of it is trust. Maybe there's this mistrust or distrust.
Yeah,
you know,
we don't have a great history.
How do I know that you really have my best interest at heart? You know, I'm just doing this for you because it's good for you or because... So I think we have done a very good job at earning their trust and really showing. I mean, we're being genuine here. We're being who we are and we really care. And a lot of our staff, we are... Mexican-American, or so we really relate to them. We actually even know what the foods they eat. And sometimes I say something that I used to say when I lived in Mexico, and they're like, and right there, that word made a connection.
Yes.
Oh, my God, my grandma used to say that, or my kids. So making those connections is just really significant to reach out to them. Once we earn their trust, we guarantee you that we're never going to lose that because it's so valuable. So you kind of have to earn their trust, and then you can tell them about the research and being culturally appropriate, and of course the science, like what works better for men, what works better for women. And I think that's why the programs that Dr. Garcia runs are being so successful. I mean, people tell you that, so
yeah.
Don't take my word, take the word of our participants, right, who said that. So it's very wonderful to experience and to see, like, oh, I want to do better, I want to do more.
So you mentioned that the program is 6 years in, So what do you hope to see for the next 6 years of the program?
In the future, I really just want to have a presence for Nosotros within the community that's going to complement everybody, and that's going to help regardless of the focus. So, like, if I'm not doing it, I will help the community get to what they need to, whether it's, like, mental health or it's, like, John's work or whoever else's work, because in reality, the Hispanic community or anybody else for that matter is going to be underrepresented in research always if we are not all helping. So I think that's kind of the goal is we want that representation because there may be effective strategy, there may be effective treatments, but we don't know. And so I think that's kind of the next wave. In addition to that, just continue with training.
Yeah.
You know, students, helping people find their career paths, helping the community find their career paths as well. I think that's going to be important.
Yeah. It's just to keep reaching out to our Hispanic community and other communities that are at disadvantage, right? And to learn more about their health interests and to just keep connecting them and helping them with resources in the community. We have to be very responsible as well. So on the one hand, we have to be careful that everybody now thinks like, whoa, the Hispanic community is a great market to reach for research. We have to be very protective of them because we don't want them to just as a commodity. We really want their well-being.
Yeah, and it's trying, like, I think that the more research that gets out there that takes the approach that you guys have at this team, where it's really getting involved in the community and not just, you know, treating people as data points and collecting that information and then saying goodbye. I think the more research teams that employ that strategy, I think that can only make research better in the future and have people have more trust. And it's kind of flipping the model that we have now on its head and making sure that people feel valued and they understand and the reason used. Why behind, not used exactly.
Or I think it's the value, it's being transparent, it also just giving people choice. I think that's the most powerful thing that you can give to somebody is choice, right? Autonomy. So, if you just give them the options, you in the context of like research, just educate or help them understand what may be good research or what may be bad, but it's not our place to dictate whether you engage in this or not. However, if I can provide you with a menu of options and let you choose what may be best for you and empower you and just be there to support you, it's kind of like the navigator aspect, right?
Yeah.
Then that's what we need to do. So I think that's kind of like the value, right? But in reality, everybody likes autonomy, and everybody should have that choice. And that's another way to reduce health disparities or improve health equity, right?
I'm not sure if you use any sort of food frequency questionnaires here, but you mentioned being culturally sensitive and having that. And I know one of the big problems, especially with studying different populations of people, is that, like, not even having the correct types of food that this population would be eating on something like a food frequency
or
questionnaire.
Or telling them to eat organic and buy their foods at Whole Foods. It's just like,
not
so exactly, right? So you need to know what's around their communities, what kind of stores, what kind of foods they eat.
And what values people
and what
have.
Values and the value of eating with a family. So it's kind of nice when you experience that or, growing up, because then, but there's people who are not, but they really have learned that because through school they traveled to other countries. So I admire that very much, that there may be somebody who never grew up in Mexico and maybe it's not even Mexican American, but they know so much. So it's not something that only I can do. It's like, if you want to do it and you want to learn about your community and you really care, everybody can be in that field at some point, you know?
And I think that's what, like, Nosotros, like, in general, right, the research program, our program has done really well, is that we do have people who just reach out to us and, like, hey, like, this has come up or whatever. Do you know someone who could help, or do you know of anybody? Because in reality, it's just that creating that link. And I do think that a lot of people do that well, but it's hard to maintain that over time. And so I think, you know, it's that that's how we get towards the prevention aspect. And also just like having everybody value prevention, right? In reality, what we're doing a lot is like secondary or tertiary care, you know, but in reality, we have to have that more complementary, that more focus on prevention that's just as valued. And then again, like the investments, you know, it takes time. But in addition to that, it's not just an investment from like a grant perspective, it's an investment in the workforce. So for instance, like our community health workers, our promotoras, those models,
Can you explain that for those who are listening that might not know what promoters
are? So community health workers are generally, I don't like to say this word, but like lay community members that don't have formal education. However, that is a definition. However, may not be the most appropriate definition because I feel they probably know more than most people.
Oh yeah.
right. So they're the individuals that I'd say are in the community who know have their pulse on the community and know exactly what the community needs, and although have not had the opportunity to go through formal education, probably know probably more than me, honestly. And those are the individuals that should be invested in heavily. And so they engage in all aspects of research. When we complement with research, they help with recruitment, they engage in community advisory boards, they serve as that voice.
Yeah, that knowledge is invaluable.
Right. It is. I mean, that is like one of the underpinnings of public health in that workforce. And so again, just how, like stepping back from resource, like, you know, recognizing that it doesn't matter about someone's degree, it doesn't matter about someone's education, it's valuing the people and the work that they do. So I think even the context of like health disparities, making sure that everything's equitable, right? And that's how we eliminate health disparities, is by improving health equity. And that actually comes in the context of kind of elevating everybody up and valuing your teams and those relationships.
Definitely. Anything?
No, and you know, there's people living in their community, so they really know them better than anybody.
Yeah.
And
yep.
Again, going back to trust, their neighbors, or you know, the people that live in those communities, they trust them, and they want the best for this, their community. So I think it's a really good model to deliver education and you know, going back to the word advocacy.
Yeah.
They're gonna be great advocates, and sometimes they're paying it forward. Somebody, I met some that somebody helped them.
Yeah.
And now they want, somebody was there for me, I want to be there for my neighbors, for the next generation, or for my kids. And it's a skill that you can teach to kids so they can self-advocate or to others.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is really, so important, really important during this time. Sure. Can you talk a little bit more about the new study that you're involved in?
Yeah. So Luna is the new study. Ironically, it's also Luis's new baby's name. So we got a couple of babies. But Luna is the liver ultrasound and nutrigenetic assessment study. And really what we're trying to do, and just some context about liver and liver disease in general right now, is that we're focused on non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, so not related to alcohol. Previously, anything related to liver is like, oh, it's alcohol-based. Well, this one's not alcohol-based. It's lifestyle-based, diet specifically, sugar-sweetened beverages, and so forth. So what's going on right now in the community, and this is specific to like Mexican origin adults, Hispanic adults, is that 1 in 3 individuals actually have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. This is like a precursor. So there's a spectrum across liver disease that like everybody has some fat in their liver, going to more like fibrosis, like cell death, or even like cirrhosis, getting towards like liver cancer. So what's going on is that, so 1 in 3 in general have that. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD. However, that increases with obesity status. So again, there's actually estimates that suggest that Hispanic men may have up to 77%. 77% of Hispanic men actually have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Now, this is in combination with a very, if you look at any cancer rates for Hispanic Latino communities right now, so they're published every year, most cancers are starting to go down. Breast significantly due to cancer screenings and so forth, prostate's going down. Everything's kind of going down with the exception of liver. Liver's on a significant increase. And it's, again, not due to, in the past, it's due to hepatitis or vaccinations and so forth, right? We kind of knew that. Now it's related to obesity. So what we are doing with Luna is a couple things. One, we're assessing the prevalence of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in our community. So in the Tucson area, from a community-based sample, not waiting for people to present. So most of the prevalence studies come from like, if you have a sign or symptom and you go and then you're referred to a clinic. We are getting individuals from the community, different community-based settings, and taking them to a clinic, Arizona Liver Health, to actually have a liver ultrasound.
So
that's step one. The other step is really, as I mentioned, it's largely related to diet. So you actually kind of mentioned dietary, you know, recalls or so forth. Like, what's appropriate? So we're doing dietary recalls.
Okay.
So we're doing 24-hour dietary recalls over three days, 2 weekdays, 1 weekend.
Okay.
To assess the influence of the diet on this. Is there an association between having NAFLD and this? In addition, what I didn't mention was that we're genetically loaded. So either myself or Rosie actually has a high-risk genetic variant or a genetic allele that basically increases our risk of having non-alcoholic fatty liver disease by 4 times.
Wow.
So it's PNPLA3, but basically this variant, if I have it, independent of my obesity status or my weight status, off the charts, I'm at an increased risk. So we're looking at gene-diet interactions, and that's actually some of Kristen Morrill's, that's going to be our dissertation focus. And the last piece of our puzzle is, most importantly, is qualitative work. So perceptions, awareness, knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. How do I convey risk to someone? How do I help people understand what that actually is if they've never heard of it before?
So what are some of the strategies for that?
Don't know.
Okay, so no,
this is very the beginning.
Okay.
So right now we're really focused on the first two. We have about 60 individuals to date that we've pulled into the, as we call it, physical assessments and do the liver ultrasound. They're completing the dietary assessments. We are in the process right now of finalizing our moderator guide so we can do that. Because that's the thing. Again, I don't know, and I don't want to go out to the community without doing my due diligence, our team, right, of asking, how do we convey that? What are the perceptions and so forth? But speaking to like the impact of this work so far, and why this is so important for everybody to just have on their radars is that, you know, this is an emerging disease state. It's very much interrelated with obesity, diabetes. And in fact, there's more literature to suggest that if individuals with type 2 diabetes, so actually in Europe, the standard of care now is to actually get a FibroScan, a liver ultrasound done. Standard of care now, because most individuals actually have this. In addition to that, we have had like about 61 or so people come in, but already 4 have been enrolled into clinical trials. And in fact, 1 individual has presented with cirrhosis. In my mind, that's very concerning, right? That even 1 person would have not known otherwise that they had this health condition. That individual will be getting treatment, I believe, now. But that's kind of the context. Like, no signs or symptoms. There is no FDA-approved drug. Mm-hmm. It's lifestyle.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the impact of the work of the team and so stuff that we're doing. So we're trying to recruit 150 men and women.
The good news is that we are trying to help everybody. So in case somebody calls and is very interested, I have people who have some knowledge. But let's say they're not eligible, we can still help you to get your ultrasound. So we're going to help everybody.
If you helped one person's life, just one person, then that's a good day at the office.
Yeah.
That in itself is public health, right?
Oh, yeah.
And again, all the listeners, I'm sure, will have that example. And I think like when we have those days that like, I didn't get the grant or I didn't get this, right, from a faculty perspective, or, you know, people didn't show up or whatever, when stuff does not go perfect all the time, and it won't, because that's just life. Always go and fall back on your small wins.
Yeah.
And so our team has definitely had that, and it's humbling work.
How do we get across the message to the public health workforce that they should be more aware of health disparities? How do we address that in our day-to-day work? How do we kind of confront those internal biases we all have anyway? How do we integrate in our work?
So I think from like public health, and if any individuals in public health, I think we all have an altruistic heart in general. I'd like to believe that. However, we all have unconscious biases that's just in general. So I always say like, and even myself, before you go into anything, like check yourself. It doesn't matter. Again, like education, social class, whatever, like you have to see people as people and understand that it's not just face value. So from that perspective, is I feel that every public health professional really just has to have that humility in themselves, and really, again, understand the people more, and not just the context of like the health disparities that exist with them, because sometimes we can't change access, we can't change income.
Huge systematic issues.
Yeah. And there's certainly models, right? That, like we understand our theoretical frameworks or whatever, but in reality, you know, the science has to complement. I can know all the data, I can know all these different numbers, but if I can't talk to a person or I can't have that connection, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So from a so any public health professional, really just kind of take that time, take a step back, put yourself in the mind frame. And then again, think about like the small wins. Like, what can we do? We're not going to solve it all, but together we can. I think, and we just got to break that down.
Another thing is learning. You know, we don't know everything. I'm a learner, so I take advantage of every symposium or conference that the university offers, maybe online. LGBTQ, you know, I am an ally, but I really don't know how to be a good ally. So I try to go to those. So take advantage of the resources that your university or online programs, or buy a book. Sometimes we have the best intentions, but we're still uneducated and ignorant. So try to educate yourself if you really want to be as correct as you can. You know, can never be perfect.
Yeah.
And we're going to be called in many occasions, but just learn from those mistakes. But I think using those resources can be very helpful.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. But I really, and even before we had, just got to acknowledge the team, because it's really the Nassau-Thoros team, right, that does it. So that's anywhere from like the doctoral students to even the undergrad, like everybody is a collective effort. So the Nassau-Thoros team in general, and in addition to Rosie, I couldn't do without you guys. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right, awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you are looking to obtain continuing education credits for listening to this podcast, please head to moodle.publichealth.arizona.edu and click on the Keeping Up with Public Health tab in the WR PHTC section and take the post-evaluation survey for this episode. This podcast is supported by the Western Region Public Health Training Center. You can find more of our work at www.wrphtc.arizona.edu. You can also find us on Twitter at WRPHTC. A special thank you to Eric Healy for editing and producing the show, in addition to creating the music for each episode.